Over the past couple of decades, through DNA testing, hundreds of people in the U.S. have been exonerated of crimes they didn't commit, including some 18 people serving time on death row. But why were they convicted in the first place? That's something John Gould has researched as the principal investigator of the Preventing Wrongful Convictions Project at American University in Washington, D.C. He's at USD for an afternoon Farber Forum presentation on why innocent people are sentenced to death, and he joins us here in the studio. And John, thanks for joining us on Dakota Midday.
Happy to be here. Glad to be back in South Dakota.
Well, to begin with, how long have you been studying wrongful convictions?
Probably about 6 or 7 years now.
And what led to that?
So it's actually an interesting story. I was teaching a class to a group of undergraduates several years ago, and we were dealing with a case out of Texas, which has euphemistically been called the sleeping lawyer case. So a man was on trial for a capital crime, and his lawyer fell asleep during the trial. And this case was obviously appealed, and the first appellate court to hear this case said that it was okay to convict the man and sentence him to death with a lawyer who was literally asleep. And a student in my class raised his hand and said, "I don't know why we're talking about anything else in the class from here forward. Clearly, the Constitution doesn't mean anything if someone can actually be convicted and sentenced to death with a lawyer who's asleep." And the court said that this was probably a strategy by the lawyer to send a message that this case was such a snoozer that he was asleep. Fortunately, a later court overturned this. But my challenge was trying to answer the student's question, and I didn't have a good answer. And so this actually led me to learn a little bit more initially about some of the problems that went into these cases. And from there, it's really turned into a whole new area that I've been researching over the last 6 years or so.
And that's what developed into the Preventing Wrongful Convictions Project?
Well, so that was actually another stage down the road. What I did before that is I worked with a group of people in Virginia to found an organization called the Innocence Commission for Virginia. And in Virginia at that time, we had 11 people who had been exonerated. And by exonerated, there was clear evidence that they had not committed the crime. These were rape and murder cases. And rather than trying to figure out, trying to argue about whether someone was innocent or not, what I was interested in and what the others I was working were interested in was trying to figure out what led to these wrongful convictions in the first place. Because no matter where we are on the ideological spectrum or where we are in the criminal justice system, I think we all agree that we want the system to work and we want to make sure that the innocent are not wrongly convicted. And so a group of us were able to get 11 law firms in Washington, D.C. and in Virginia to give us $500,000 worth of pro bono time of their lawyers to investigate these cases, to figure out what had gone wrong, and to make some recommendations to try to prevent those errors in the future. And so that was actually my first foray into this.
And what are you finding, or what have you found?
So a number of the things that we found are things that people have known for a number of years who've looked at these cases. There are problems with eyewitness identification procedures. There are problems with people being led into a confession that's not accurate. There are problems with forensic evidence, lots of problems with defense lawyering in terms of not enough resources and not enough time being brought to bear on these cases. But I think probably the biggest problem of all is one that ties these all together, and that's one of tunnel vision. And this is something that I think many of us actually understand in our everyday lives. We look at something and we think we understand what's going on. So a police officer or a prosecutor looks at some of the evidence and thinks, well, it's got to be suspect A over here. And we get invested in that conclusion and that assumption. And it becomes harder for us to look at other evidence or to investigate further when things aren't turning out to be logical, to then figure out what else may be going on here. And that is probably the number one thing that ties all of this together.
So how do you go about preventing this tunnel vision or getting beyond it?
So that's a real challenge, and psychologists have been looking at this for years. And I think anyone, I jokingly say, anyone who's married knows that it's very difficult to convince anyone once he or she thinks of something to see the world a little bit differently through tunnel vision or to fight tunnel vision. Mm-hmm. But the way we do it, or I think the way that any of us can do it, is number one, to be, first of all, aware that it exists, that when we think we understand something, that we need to oftentimes be open to alternative interpretations. But the other thing in the criminal justice system is training. So at police academies, with new prosecutors, certainly with defense lawyers as well, to be able to look at some of the cases where things went wrong and to put people in the shoes of the police officer at the opening part of the investigation. So here you come upon the scene. Here's the evidence that you have before you. What's your initial thinking? What's your initial assumption? And to keep testing that as we go further along. Okay, so the next thing that the officer had was a witness who said this. Now, what do we know about that witness? Okay, now what are you assuming at this moment? And to continue to go forward. The other thing that is very important in criminal cases is to do the forensic testing earlier rather than later. Because what we find sometimes is if the forensic testing is done later in an investigation, if the findings come back and they don't match with what the police and the prosecutor's assumption is, they are less likely to accept the forensic testing results there as being dispositive as if they came in earlier. So if you have a DNA test that's done very early in an investigation and it excludes a suspect as the giver of the bodily fluid, police and prosecutors are more likely to close off their investigation into that person there, saying, well, the DNA shows he wasn't at the crime scene or didn't leave the blood at the crime scene, rather than if it comes in later where they've begun to become invested in this suspect. People have a tendency, and this is just a natural human tendency, to start discounting the contrary evidence. Well, maybe he was present and didn't shed any hairs, or maybe he bled, but it was somewhere and we didn't find it. And so people end up explaining away evidence if it comes in later.
So there's already this storyline or theory that they already have, and they're down that path, and it's harder to then go the other direction.
Right, and it's true in all sorts of areas of life. In fact, the National Transportation Safety Board talks about this regularly in the context of plane accidents, where pilots think they are seeing the what's going on through one lens, and actually something else is going on. There's a different part of the plane that's malfunctioning, or they're in clouds and they're actually turned around. And so there's training for pilots now in how to deal with the issue of tunnel vision as well.
So it sounds like this is more trying to overcome human nature with the tunnel vision than an inherent flaw in the criminal justice system, or maybe it's a little bit of both?
Well, I'd say it's both. And to me, the flaw is that systemically across the country, we don't stop and try to learn from the problems that happen in the criminal justice system. Now, I'm happy to say that in our research, most of the cases of wrongful conviction that we came across were not intentional. So they are not ones. And there are some of these, and I am from Chicago, and unfortunately the Chicago Police Department had a history at some times of knowing someone, or pretty much knowing someone was innocent, and yet trying to get them to confess to a crime they didn't commit. But that's not the norm across the country. Most of these cases are caused by people of goodwill trying to do the right thing, but making tragic errors as they do it. And I'm willing to say that we have to kind of accept that some of those are going to happen. What we should not be accepting is failing to learn from these. And we really don't have situations systematically, where police departments or prosecutors stop and look at the cases that went wrong to try to figure out what happened. And I contrast this with the transportation industry. When a plane crashes in the United States, there is an agency whose job it is to go out and investigate what happened, to try to figure out what errors occurred so that we can come up with measures to prevent this from happening again. The criminal justice system has many more errors on a daily basis than does the transportation industry. Now, granted, a plane crash, many more victims than an individual case. But it's almost like we are scared as a discipline in criminal justice to learn from the errors, as if something bad will happen from figuring out that this particular thing went wrong. And what I would say in answer to that is we've actually seen that by doing post-error analysis, we can come up with some measures that actually not only work at preventing the wrongful conviction, but also help in securing an accurate conviction. And the classic example here are police departments that have imposed or have started to use videotaping in interrogations. And actually, St. Paul, Minnesota is a police department that has gone ahead and implemented this. And what they find in situations like this is that they cut down on false confessions, because if you're videotaping the interrogation start to finish, police officers generally follow the book, and also jurors are able to look at the situation and figure out, was there undue influence brought to bear? Does it look like the defendant actually was confessing to something he knew, as opposed to in Virginia, we had a case where the police were interrogating a man with a very, very low IQ and held up a T-shirt from the crime scene and asked him to describe it. And this was then later used as evidence that he knew what that T-shirt looked like beforehand. So the videotaping prevents that. It also helps in securing guilty pleas from people who truly confessed to a crime they did. Because if their interrogation's on videotape, they can't walk away from it as easily. There's no claim that there was undue influence by the police. And oftentimes they will plead and the case will be over faster. So these kinds of things can really work not only in preventing wrongful convictions, but improving the way the criminal justice system secures accurate convictions.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and we're talking with John Gould. He's the principal investigator of the Preventing Wrongful Convictions Project at American University, and he's at USD for this afternoon's Farber Forum, Why Innocent People Are Sentenced to Death. That presentation begins at 4 o'clock at USD's Farber Hall here on campus. Is there anything different about the cases of innocent people sentenced to death in comparison to other wrongful convictions, or are they pretty much the same things are at play?
The same causes are at play. They are more likely to have their convictions overturned, though, because they get the kind of time and attention and investigation post-conviction that many others who are convicted of lower-level crimes don't. And so a lot of what we know about the sources of wrongful convictions come from these more serious, the capital cases, but we are also now seeing more and more other kinds of crimes where people are being exonerated, and we're learning from them as well. But again, most of the sources are common across all kinds of cases.
Now, the research, the results of the studies that you've done through this project, has there been response to this? Has people in the criminal justice system been interested in maybe applying some of these things that you're talking about or looking at them?
A number of agencies are, and I have to give a lot of credit to a number of the police departments around the country and some of the prosecutors who are beginning to look at these issues. I will be actually in Texas next week working with a group of Texas police chiefs who are interested in figuring out what they can, what lessons there are to be learned from these cases and what they can do to implement these measures because, again, they don't want wrongful convictions either. We want to get to justice as quickly but as accurately as possible. So I've been very pleased by the response by a number of justice agencies, and it really shows that we have moved past a period where criminal justice was a vocation. We're now at a place where it's a profession.
There's been a number of the criminal justice reforms. There have been some in South Dakota dealing with drug courts and that sort of thing, looking at different ways of sentencing. I don't know if that really gets into any of the research that you do, or is any of that a result of some of this?
No.
Is that a separate category?
Separate category, although I think what they all have in common is that we are, as a society, trying to get what's called smart on crime rather than simply tough on crime. Mm-hmm. And so I'm pleased to see that there are a number of justice administrators and officials, even elected officials, who are beginning to question why and how we have done things to see if we can get the same result. And the same result we all want is to reduce crime. I cannot think of anyone out there who truly wants to see crime on the rise. What we're all trying to get to is a reduction in crime and to do it accurately. So as I think we've hit a period where people are beginning to look a little bit more questioning at measures that they have followed, we're seeing some openness to not only things like drug courts and what to do about mandatory minimums on certain crimes, but also, at least in my neck of the woods, I'm thinking about how we go about ensuring that the person who is being put on trial is the person who truly did the crime.
Does it seem like we're at some sort of point where things are changing over the past couple of years, the way we're dealing with criminal justice?
I think we're getting there. And actually, ironically, I think it has been the downturn in the economy that's been the driver here. We spend so much money on our criminal justice system as a proportion of governmental budgets. And at a time where everyone's, you know, tight for money, we need to make sure that that money is being spent appropriately and efficiently. And I've seen a number of states where what was the driver in having them think about how their criminal justice system works is the fact that they're having to cut budgets. And so whatever the reason is, and I'm sorry we're at a point where we have to cut budgets because of the economy, but if that's what drives criminal justice reform, so be it.
Well, John, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to stop by and talk with us on Dakota Midday.
My pleasure. Thanks.
John Gould is the principal investigator of the Preventing Wrongful Convictions Project at American University. And again, he's at the University of South Dakota for this afternoon's Farber Forum, Why Innocent People Are Sentenced to Death. The presentation begins at 4 o'clock at USD's Farber Hall.